This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Going to deal with the Sedra, in fact, but to carry on with the series that we're right in the middle of, which we started 2 weeks ago, and which we'll be busy with at least still tonight and possibly a little bit longer. Just to summarize how far we've got, 2 weeks ago we used the Medrash that dealt with Moshe Rabbeinu setting aside the three cities, although he knew that he could not complete the mitzvah, where the Medrash brought the posuk from Koheles, Oyev Kesef Lo Yispa Kesef, that a person who loves money will never have enough money. And the Medrash extended that to Oyev Torah Lo Yispa Torah, a person who loves Torah will never have enough Torah, Oyev Mitzvahs Lo Yispa Mitzvahs, and so on. And the first yesod that we drew from that Medrash was the principle of the test of love being in the degree of seviyah, whether one can become satisfied. The pasuk says that ohev kesef lo yisba kesef, if one loves money one will never have enough, and the Medrash extends that to various other objects as well. And we see that it is part of the element of love never to have enough. If it is possible to reach seviyah, if it is possible to reach the point where it's genuk, I've had enough, then what one had up till then was not love at all. We talked about the fact that something as unselfish as love is compared to something which where there's no seviyah. Seviyah is like a hunger. A seviyah is like the satisfaction from hunger. We compared it to the act of eating, and we talked about the fact that just as eating is the satisfaction of a need, one needs to eat and one satisfies that need, so loving is also a need that the human being has, and there's nothing embarrassing about that, and there's nothing selfish about that. It is the Ribbono Shel Olam who created our needs within us, and we are obliged to fill those needs, and filling them according to the Torah is the way of Kedusha, it's the way of holiness, and that's perfectly in order. The first test, however, was it's got to be a hunger for which there is no satisfaction. When one is hungry for something physical, when you've got the thing that you are hungry for, the hunger disappears. When one is hungry for something spiritual, the hunger never disappears, and that is love. And the second test was that one does something even not only for the end purpose. In other words, irrespective of the end result, one enjoys the action for its own end as well. Even Moshe knew, for example, even though Moshe knew that there was no way he could finish the mitzvah, and theoretically that it would have been just as good to leave the mitzvah for Yehoshua to do in its entirety, because until Yehoshua completed it, it wasn't complete. In any case, it was Yehoshua who had to end it off, so he might as well have done the whole thing. Nevertheless, I have mitzvahs, lo yisba mitzvahs. If you love something, you enjoy it. And here again, we had the comparison with the act of eating, where although the true purpose of our eating is in order to have good health, we need vitamins and we need nutrition, and that's really why we eat. But while we're about it, we enjoy the act of eating as well. And even if it wouldn't be so nutritious, we also enjoy it. And there's some things, in fact, which are downright unnutritious, and we enjoy it too. It's not only because of the end result. We are capable of enjoying the action as well, provided we're hungry. Where there is hunger, the satisfaction of that hunger in itself is a cause for satisfaction and is a cause for enjoyment, if there is that hunger. And the hunger that we're talking about in the relationship of love is exactly like that. It is a hunger. And therefore the fulfillment of that hunger is in itself fulfilling and enjoyable. The thing is, though, unlike food, one doesn't get to the point where one has had enough, where it's genuk. Last week we extended that further, and we said in that case, let us use those two tests of love to examine the human being's relationship with himself. Normally people don't think that they love themselves. Normally that's not the normal thought. One considers that there are people that one loves more than oneself. But if you use these two tests, we find that it's not quite so. Number one, we said that the first test is, e severe one must never get satisfied. And we discussed how no matter how boring an individual may be, he never has enough of himself. He's always happy to spend more time with himself. That's one form of company that he never tires of. And also, the fact that when he's doing something for himself, quite apart from the results and quite apart from the effects of what he's doing, even if he's not going to achieve anything, as long as he knows that he's doing something for himself, he enjoys it, he gets hanor from it, he gets kishmak out of it. So we see that using the two tests of love, which we developed from the Medrash in Parshas Vayeschonon, we see the taka. There's no one one loves as much as we love ourselves. There is nobody we are more tolerant of than we are of ourselves. There's nobody whose company we enjoy as much as we enjoy our own. There's nobody's opinions we enjoy hearing as much as we enjoy hearing our own opinions. And there's nothing, no one one enjoys doing things for more than we enjoy doing things for ourselves. So we love ourselves, there's no question about it. If those are the signs of love, then there is no love like the love of a human being for himself. We then use the principle developed by the Akeda that similars attract, not different people. And he showed how the more distant an object is from an individual, the less he loves it. An inanimate object, a vegetation, an animate object, another human being, a human being from a similar culture, a human being from the same family, and so it goes on. On the basis of that, he discussed the relationship of a man to a woman, which is also one of similars, and he developed a particular creation of the woman in as much as she differed from the creation of all of the other female species, in order to give expression to this very concept that she had to be a part of him in order that there should be true love, because love it exists between two people who are close to one another, not between two people who are far from one another. And that too was a very acceptable extension of the principle that we love ourselves. The people we love most are ourselves, because we're closest to ourselves. It becomes an art requiring skill to extend the love that we feel for ourselves to other people. And they have to be people who are close, and the closer they are, the easier it is for us to love them. But the start of the love is ourselves. That's where it all starts from. But then we have the difficulty, what about the Ribbono Shel Olam? So how do people love God? Because there is nothing more distant from what the human being is than the Ribbono Shel Olam. We are physical and he is spiritual. We are transient and he is eternal. We occupy a specific place and he occupies the whole world. Molech Ol Oretz Kavoda. There is nothing more distant, there is nothing more different than the Ribbono Shel Olam, who is far beyond our conception of what that difference is. And we discussed last week what do we understand, how much do we understand of the previous generation. And Gemara says if they were like angels, we're like human beings. If they were like human beings, we're like donkeys. That means that you're able to understand as much about the previous generation as a donkey can understand about its balabos. That is the extent of one's ability to intellectually conceive of the greatness of one generation back. We're talking about one generation back. We're talking about our parents' generation, and two generations back, and three generations back, and to the generations of the Rishonim, and to the generations of the Amiroim, and the Tanoim, and the Nevi'im. You go back, go to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, to Moshe, to Yosef. Can we conceive of one little tiny aspect of their greatness? It's not possible. We've never seen anything like it. A human being cannot conceive of something which is beyond him, something he's never been exposed to at all. We're not able to conceive of it. It's completely foreign to us. We just don't understand it, not one bit of it. How much more so are we unable to begin to fathom the extent of the greatness of the Ribbono Shel Olam himself? It's just not possible. We don't understand it and we don't know it. In that case, how can we love him? If even people, two human beings, but if they're far from one another, if they're different to one another, there is an interference in their relationship of love between them, how much more so between man and God? How is it possible for there to exist between the Ribbono Shel Olam and a human being a relationship of such love? And we use the Akedah's second principle of love, which he develops in Vayeschonon, in fact not in Bereishis, where he says really love can exist between two people who are very different, provided they are different not laterally, but they are different vertically. People who are different laterally, it's very difficult for there to be love between them. But if they are different vertically, there can be love between them. Two conditions need to be fulfilled. Number one, there has to be yira. The greater one must be held in awe by the younger one. That's the first condition that must be there. And the second condition is that the greater one must be the distributor of goodness and kindness to the younger one. So if the junior one sees the other one as great and is in awe of him, and in addition to that he's continually receiving kindness and goodness from him, then automatically a love relationship develops. And we spoke about the Patty Hearst phenomenon, and we spoke about the relationship of a child to his parents. While a parent may see a child as an extension of himself, a child does not see himself as an extension of his parents. How does he develop a love for his parents? We talked about this, provided there is a yira, provided he holds his parents in awe, and in addition to that they do goodness, which every parent does, then it's shaykh, then it is possible for there to be ahava, for a love to develop. But if that doesn't exist, if those two conditions don't exist, then it isn't possible. And so it says, the arcade of the relationship of love between the Ribbono Shel'olam and the human being is clearly understood. We stand in awe of the Ribbono Shel'olam, and he distributes kindness to us day and night, all the time, so love develops. And that's why it's said in last week, Sedra v'ata Yisrael ma'ashem alokechem shul mitchem, what does the Ribbono Shel'olam ask of you? Ki'im li'yira. All he asks is to that you should fear him. And then it goes on, and love him and keep his mitzvahs and all the other things. So the Akeda, that's a natural consequence, provided there's yira, if you have awe and fear of the Ribbono Shel'olam, since he also does goodness and kindness, automatically the love will come, and once you love him, you'll keep his mitzvahs, and so it goes on. And that, in fact, says the Akeda, is the Pshat and the Shema. When we say Shema Yisrael, listen Israel, Hashem Elokeinu, what does that mean? Hashem is our God, Elokeinu. Elokeinu is the term we use to describe God in his relationship to us. Hashem is God in his essence. That's the Ribbono Shel'olam. But Elokeinu is in his capacity as one who is God to us. Shema Yisrael, Hashem, this God is not just a God that sits up there and does nothing. He's Elokeinu, he dishes out kindness to us. And Hashem Echod, there's nobody like him. He's one. He controls everything, he is everything, he is over everything. So here we have the two elements. We have Elokeinu, that he gives us kindness, and we have the Echad, that we stand in awe of this magnificence of whatever we're able to conceive of the Ribbono Shel'olam. But one thing we know is that it's absolutely unique and unified. There isn't anything that comes anywhere near it, or is in any way separate from it. That we know for sure. And therefore the natural follow on from that is Be'ahavto es Hashem Elokecha. Therefore, and you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your might. That is the consequence of Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad. That's how the Akeda explains the Shema on the basis of the principles which we developed last week. The Maharal deals with very similar questions and is disturbed by very similar things that we've been discussing over the last 2 weeks. And he tries a line very similar to the Akeda. He asks the same question, how do we love God? How can there be love between something so far from us as the Ribbono Shel'olam himself? And he tries various answers. One of them is an answer very similar to the Akeda. But he asks a question on that answer. And he says, in that case, we should also be instructed to love our parents and to love our Rabbein. There is no, believe it or not, there's no instruction. A child is not obliged to love his parents, much to the disillusionment of many parents. No, he doesn't have to love the parents. Nowhere does it say that a child must love the parents. Nor does it say that you have to love your Rabbeim, that one has to love one's teachers and one's leaders. You don't have to love them. Yiro, yes. There must be awe, but not doesn't say love. Asks the Maharal, according to this principle, if we're going to accept that where there is awe as well as favor, love will follow, what greater situation is there than a parent? A parent where there's got to be awe, there's a din, that you've got to respect the parents and you've got to hold the parents in awe. And the parent is doing favor, the parent provides shelter and he provides food and he provides clothing and he provides education. So every minute of the day the child is benefiting. So where's the mitzvah to love the parents? And we learn, if Hashem Elokecha Tiron, you remember Shim Shanam Suni learned, and that the Rabbis of Talmidei Chachamim, that comes to include Talmidei Chachamim, that you must hold them in awe as well. And what about Ve'ahavtes Hashem Elokecha? Why doesn't he say also that you've got to love Talmidei Chachamim as well? It doesn't say anywhere that you have to love them. And on the basis of that, the Maharal actually rejects this explanation and goes on to another. The Maharal's question, I don't fully understand, but the Maharal is a sefer that altogether it's not easy to understand, and one has to spend a lot of time on it. He's one of the casualties of modern learning, where people don't even realize what work has to go into understanding a Gemara, a Rashi, a Tosfos, the hours and hours of sweat and toil that has to go into it. If they're coming to a shir, so they hear the shir, they hear the Rashi and the Tosfos explained, and that's all there is to it. They don't realize what work has to go into understanding it. And if they're learning it themselves, they tend to read it very superficially and not really understand what's going on altogether. And the Maharal too, it's the kind of sefer, at least unlike a Gemara. Gemara, it's easy to show a person that he doesn't know what he's talking about. Because you can show him, he says, you ask him what does Tosfos say, and he says X, Y, Z, and you say, if that's what Tosfos says, then how do you explain this? And it doesn't take very long, and he realizes that really he has no clue what Tosfos is saying, and he needs to start again. But when you come onto philosophy, and to things like the Maharal, it's very difficult to show a person that he hasn't understood the first thing about the Maharal. All we can say is that provided one is a Talmid Chochem Mashlik, and one can learn a piece of Gemara Rashi Tosfos properly, and one knows how to learn a Rambam, and one knows how to learn a Shulchan Aruch and a Bir Hagro, and one can learn a little bit, then if you spend many, many hours on an essay of the Maharal, you might understand. It's possible that one will understand parts of it. But one thing we should know for sure, that if any of those don't apply, either we are not very big Talmidei Chachomim, or we did not spend many, many hours on the Maharal, please, for all future reference, in case one day Chas V'Sholom they should translate the Maharal into English, as they've done to so many other books, please know that unless those two conditions apply, that you're a bit of a London in Gemara, and you've spent many, many hours sweating over a paragraph or two of the Maharal, know for sure that not only you don't understand it, but know that you've misunderstood it. It's not possible to understand it on superficial reading. And the tragedy is that one thinks one understands it. You read through it, it all makes sense. It's sort of modern Hebrew. It goes very nicely. It's very beautifully written. And one thinks one knows what he's talking about. So I say the question of the Maharal I don't understand, but I say that with a reservation, that the Maharal is a sefer that at the best of times it is very difficult to understand. The reason that I don't understand it is one could say quite simply that the love for a teacher and the love for a parent is included in Ve'ahavta L'Reacha Kamoicha. There is a general law that is given. You must love all Yidden. Ve'ahavta L'Reacha Kamoicha. You must love all people. So there's no need to give a special din that you must love a teacher and you must love a parent and you must love this one and you must love that one. They're all included already. It doesn't include God. We need to be told Ve'ahavtas Hashem Elokecha, because that we haven't been told anywhere else. But you don't really need to tell us a special din that you love a parent and that you love a teacher. Maybe that's taken for granted. But the Maharal doesn't accept that answer. He doesn't give that answer. He's disturbed by the question. So there must be some reason for it. What I'm interested in more is not so much the Maharal's question as the Maharal's answer, which is a different way of understanding Ahavas Hashem. And this different way of understanding Ahavas Hashem is going to bring us on to a slightly different way of understanding the Ahava, the love between individuals, between people. The Maharal starts with the Gemara in Brochus. And I'll tell you also, just to give you another clue for learning Maharal, that if you haven't looked up every Gemara that he brings and learned through every Gemara with Rashi and with the Maharshor where it applies, or with Tosfos where it applies, and you haven't spent a good deal of time on each Gemara he brings, don't think and pretend that you've understood the Maharal. It's not possible. The Gemara that he brings is the famous story of Rabbi Akiva's last moments, where he was caught by the Romans for teaching Torah in public during a time when they prohibited it. And says the Gemara in Brotus Samach Aleph Amud Beis, B'shor shehitziu et Rabbi Akiva laharego, at the moment that they took Rabbi Akiva out to be killed, Zman Krishma Hoyo, it was just the time of Krishma. Vohyu Sorkim es Besoroi b'masrekes shel Barzel, and they were busy skinning him alive. Literally, they had combs of with steel teeth, and they were taking the skin off him little by little until he would finally die. And he was busy saying Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. He was busy accepting the yoke of the kingdom of heaven. Amru lo talmidov rabbeinu ad kan. They said to him, the talmidim said to him, they were standing with him and comforting him, they said, Rebbe, is this how far one's meant to go? That while you're standing in such agony and such pain, are you meant to be saying Kriya Shema? Is that how far Torah goes? Amalem, he looked at them in amazement and he said, Kol yomai ayisu mitzvair ha-posuk zeh. My whole life I've been disturbed about the fulfillment of this posuk. Bechol nafshecho, where it says in the Shema that you must love Hashem with all your soul, and the Gemara learns, afilu noitzel lishmatecho, that even if they are busy killing you, at that very moment you've got to love the Ribbono shel Olam. Omarti mosa yovel liyodai v'kaimenu. I said to myself, when will I ever be able to do that? All the other things in the Torah I'll do, I can do. But that even at the moment that I'm busy being killed, I must love the Ribbono shel Olam. How many people are likely, he said to himself, to have the privilege, so to say, of being killed slowly enough to be able to actually, at the moment of their dying, say such a thing. And here I've got the opportunity. And you're asking me where the Torah goes so far? You ask me amazingly, is one meant to do this too? Do you realize that this is a fulfillment of a lifetime ambition, he says to his Talmidim, for me to stand dying loving the Ribbono shel Olam? V'yashav shebo liyodi lo akaimenu. Do you think at this moment I'm going to give it up and not fulfill that posuk? Hayomarich be'echot. And then he said, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echod. And he said the Echod out loud for a long time. Echod. Had sheyotzes on ishmosu be'echod. And he died while he was saying Echod. Yotzes a baskel, a heavenly voice came out for Omron and it said, Ashrecho Rabbi Akiva sheyotzu nishmosko be'echod. Lucky, happy are you, Rabbi Akiva, who died at the point of saying echod. The Maral asks, what's all this got to do with loving God? What's the v'ahavta es Hashem Elokecho? That you must love God, dafka, and while you're dying, and at the moment of saying echod, how do these three things tie in? The loving of God, saying echod, and while you're busy dying. And he brings a din, that is, that even if one has said Kriya Shema and Shul, one has davened Ma'ariv, and one has said Kriya Shema, the din is that when you go to bed, you've got to say Kriya Shema again. But the din is, strictly speaking, a Talmid Chacham doesn't have to say Kriya Shema again, because he's busy thinking in Torah in any case. Part of the reason of saying Kriya Shema when one goes to bed is one's about to give one's soul over to the Ribbono shel Olam. It's a sort of a semi-death sleep. It's part of the way to death. One's actually becoming subconscious and unconscious, and it's a nerve-wracking experience for people who are sensitive to that kind of thing. And we say Kriya Shema before so that the Ribbono shel Olam should be good to us and to keep us safe. But Talmid Chacham is busy thinking in Torah in any case, and as he goes to sleep he's busy thinking in Torah. He doesn't have to stop and say Kriya Shema. He's learning in any event, so he doesn't have to say Kriya Shema. But the din is he does have to say B'yodcho afki druchi. I'm about to deposit my soul in your hand. Says the Maharal, that implies that if one isn't the Talmid Chacham and you say Kriya Shema, you don't have to say that posuk. You don't have to say I'm about to deposit my soul in your hand. We nowadays the full Kriya Shema Lamita includes all this and many other psukim. But strictly speaking, Kriya Shema Lamita is Shema Yisrael, and if you don't say Shema Yisrael, at least you must say B'yodcha Afki Druchi, I'm about to deposit my soul in your hand. Ask the Maharal, why don't we have to say it? If there's something special about saying B'yodcha Afki Druchi, why does it help to say Kriya Shema instead? Maybe you should say Kriya Shema, but you should also say after Kriya Shema, as we do, B'yodcha Afki Druchi. But the Maharal works out from the Gemara, obviously perfectly correctly, that strictly speaking, you don't have to say that. Strictly speaking, it is enough to say Shema Yisrael. So says the Maharal, somewhere buried inside Shema Yisrael must be the same concept as B'yodcha Afki Druchi, that you don't have to say it twice. He says, of course it is. He says, what does it mean, Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad? Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, God is one, means that Ein Oid Milvado, there's nothing besides God. Whatever there is the Ribbono Shel Olam. Take God away, there is nothing. There is nothing real in the world apart from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's all the Ribbono Shel Olam. And therefore, he says, it's quite normal that when I become subconscious or unconscious at the time of sleep, my neshama, which is also part of the Ribbono Shel Olam, obviously as it is released, goes back to the Ribbono Shel Olam. So by declaring Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, and going to sleep, I'm automatically declaring that I'm part of the Ribbono Shel Olam, that my soul is part of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and while I'm asleep, my soul will be deposited with the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's taken for granted. It's not necessary to say, B'yodcha afkid ruchi. Therefore, he says that is the same principle with Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was explaining the meaning of Echad and the concept of Ahavas Hashem. Says the Maharal, we love things that are very close to us. There is nothing we love more than we love ourselves. Actually, on that very point, the Maharal also doesn't go, strictly speaking, according to the way we've developed it. But leave that aside and don't worry about it. The way we've discussed it, there is nothing that we love and nobody that we love more than ourselves, because we're at one with ourselves, we're close. So says the Maharal, one can love something that is opposite to you, provided it completes you, provided it complements you. And then the two together become one. And love is when there is one. The same way we love ourselves because we are ourselves, so we love anything else which we see as ourselves. So if we are lacking something and another person or something else is able to be to us that which we are lacking, it's not that we're two anymore, then we become one. The two become a completed circle. Like Lavdil, the Eastern religions, the yin and the yang business, the two actually fit together to form a complete circle. Each one on its own is incomplete. That's the understanding of Ahavas, as the Maharal. And therefore, if we're all part of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and our soul actually is a sort of a spark of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and when we sleep, it shoots back to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Of course, there's love between us and the Ribbono Shel Olam. We are the Ribbono Shel Olam, and the Ribbono Shel Olam is us. It's all one. There is nothing but God. So what are we? We're part of Him. He's part of us. Once that's the case, then of course there's Ahava. The same as we love ourselves, so how much more so do we love the Ribbono Shel Olam, says the Maharal. In fact, the concept of love applies by nobody or nothing so much as it applies naturally in the relationship between man and the Ribbono Shel Olam. We are one with the Ribbono Shel Olam more than we are one with anything else in the world. And therefore there is nothing that we should and could love as much as we love the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's how he works it out. And therefore he says that's what Rabbi Akiva was saying. That the Ahavta Hashem Elokecha is because Hashem Echad. Since God is one and we are part of one, are part of the Ribbono Shel Olam, we love Him. It's absolutely natural and normal that there is no greater love than the love between the Jew and the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the moment of expressing that love most clearly is at the moment of death, when your soul shoots back to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's when you really see how much we are one and how close we really are. At that point one can give expression to Hashem Echad and to the Ahavtas Hashem Elokecha v'chol levavcha v'chol nafshecha v'chol moedecha. And so at that moment, that's when he wanted to die. So just to summarize and to understand the difference between the Maharal and the Akedah, the Maharal says, yes, God is far from us. No question, He's distant, He's beyond our comprehension, He's opposite in every way. But nevertheless, there can be love, because where there is Yirah plus Chesed, where there is awe plus kindness, love develops. The Maharal says, no, God is not far from us, He just appears to be far from us. But in essence, He's terribly close, and the proof is that when we die, the soul goes back. When we sleep, the soul goes back. So we're constantly part of the Ribbono Shel Olam, and our soul is craving to come closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. That's its natural state of being, craving to get back there. What greater love is there than that? That's how the Maharal learns it. Once that is the case, then it opens a new avenue to us to explore. What about loving other people? The Ahavta L'Reyecha Kamoicha. What is it that gets in the way of two human beings loving one another? If they were just spiritual, if there was no physical aspect to them, and let us use the principle of the Mahara. So we're all part of God, and it is natural for me to love the Ribbono Shelom, because Einoid Milvado, there is nothing but the Ribbono Shelom. So he and I are one. And what about you and God? Are also one. So then you and I are also one. It's very simple. Must be that way. So if we would look at ourselves purely spiritually, the same way as my soul shoots up there when I sleep, and when I will die, so Yitzhak Hashem, my soul will also shoot up there, so will yours. So we see that why did both our souls shoot up to the same place? Because that's where they belong, at the same place. They're all part of the same big soul. They're all part, so to say, of the Ribbono Shelem's whole kingdom up there. So we're one. So what is it that stops people loving from us? If the principle is that the closer one is, the more love there is. If the principle is that we love ourselves because there is nothing between ourselves and ourselves. We are one with ourselves. So we should love everybody like that. We're all one with ourselves, with each other. So the answer is, what gets in the way are material things. Spiritual things don't get in the way. In terms of the spiritual relationship between human beings, there should be natural and automatic ahava. There should be natural and automatic love between all Jewish people, because they're all part of the same neshama, ultimately. And there's a lot of talk about the fact that one has to see the Am Yisrael, the Jewish people, the Kuzri talks about it, as different parts of the same body. And the same as nobody would think of despising their hand or their leg or their head. It's all part of you. So it is, one part of the Jewish people with another part of the Jewish people. It's all one body. If one person suffers, other parts of the people automatically suffer. The fact that we might not be sensitive enough to feel that, that's another problem. But in essence, we're all part of the same body. And therefore, there should be natural and instantaneous love between all Jews. What gets in the way is material things. We need to understand also one talks about being religious, one talks about learning Torah, observing Torah. There is no question that to be involved in Torah, really, truly involved in Torah, not superficially involved and not externally involved, but to be at one with Torah, to be part of Torah, and to have Torah as part of oneself, one cannot be too much of a material person. It doesn't mean that one doesn't live a material life. We do. We put in a material world, we live material lives. But if one's thinking is material, if one's value system is material, if the pressures under which one operates are material, if the things one worries about are material, if one finds that one's head is involved in material things and one's whole being is involved in material things, how much Torah is one likely to be able to understand? It's not terribly feasible that one should be able to understand terribly much. It is a requirement of making great progress in Torah that one chisels away a lot of the outer shell of material involvement. That's it. We live our material life, but that's secondary. That's to support our spiritual lives. Not chas v'sholem that we live our material lives. That's the real thing. And one of the things we do is we also have a religious life. We daven and we keep Shabbos and we keep Yom Tov and we go to a shir. That's one of the activities that we do. But our lives, what we really are, is the material thing. Then there's no way that one can make the kind of progress that a person is really meant to make in Yiddishkeit. To do that slowly, one has to get rid of the material. To be able to merge one's mind with Torah's thinking. To be able to merge one's heart with Torah feeling. Torah is spiritual. Torah is from the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's all ruchnius. Is it possible for a physical being, for a material being, to merge his mind and his soul with Torah? It's not possible. It isn't feasible. There needs to be a tzairo. There needs to be a kedusha. One needs to. There needs to be a certain disassociation over a period of time from material things, and a total involvement in terms of one's mind and one's feelings in Torah. Very similar to the fact that there cannot be love between two human beings if there is a material barrier between them. In order for one individual to love the other, they've got to be relating spiritually to one another. If they're relating spiritually to one another, there can't be these material things. So I love the other person except that he happens to be a competitor of mine, And then jealousy starts, and he is getting to my customers, and I'm getting to his customers, and after all, there's only so much money available in the world, and if he gets it first, I suffer, and if I get it first, he's suffering, and all of a sudden we forget about the fact that spiritually we're the same person. Doesn't make much difference if he gets it or I get it, doesn't make any difference if this hand gets it or that hand gets it. After all, we're all part of the same neshama. The spirit, the physical thing is just that we should be able to eat. And I know, since he's part of me, that if chas v'sholem I was starving and I had nothing to eat, I know he would support me. And if he was starving and he couldn't eat, he knows I would support him. So is it terribly important if he gets the business or I get the business? But for that one needs to be operating spiritually. And we don't operate spiritually, we operate like animals, physically, materially, viciously. After every little scrap of food that we can find, we go with all we've got, and our whole mind and our whole thought, and we sit up at night and we plan and we scheme how to get a little bit more, and how to get in before the other person, and how to be a step ahead before them. That's what our minds are involved in all the time. Is it possible for there to be love between human beings when that's going on? It's not possible. Likewise, at those moments, it's not possible to have a spiritual relationship with the Torah itself. Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelm says that is the meaning, or one of the meanings, in the pasuk that we've been dealing with now for 3 weeks. V'yahavto l'reicha kamecha, says the Gemara, ze klal gadol b'Torah. This is a big rule in Torah. Right? You shall love your neighbor as yourself. This is a big rule in Torah. Says Rav Simcha Zissel, it means just that. It's a big rule in Torah. If you want to advance in Torah, you need to love your neighbor as yourself. Because the only way you'll ever love your neighbor as yourself is when you've extinguished all the material barriers between you and your neighbor. When you've extinguished all the material barriers, you're operating as a neshama. You're operating with a soul, with a spirit, with a real neshama. At that point, you can start learning. At that point, you can understand Torah. At that point, you can get close to Torah, close to the Ribbono Shel Olam, close to the mitzvahs. When you're keeping Shabbos, it's a spiritual Shabbos. When you're keeping Yom Tov, it's a spiritual Yom Tov. Then it's beautiful. This is an incredible concept. That it's in fact through the moral side of Torah. It's through breaking down the material barriers and becoming at one with other people that one can make the necessary progress in Torah. V'yahavta l'reicha kamoicha, you should love your neighbor as yourself. Ze klal gadol b'Torah, that's a big rule in Torah. That's a rule in learning, that's a rule in keeping the mitzvah, that's a rule in being frum. That's where it comes from. Over the last few weeks we've had several shiurim dealing with the fact that not only is religiousness no guarantee to refinement, but in fact, if one isn't working on one's refinement separately and consciously, the more religious one comes, the less refined one becomes. It was one of the big chiddushim that we had only a few weeks ago. That the closer one gets to God, the more dangerous it is. And in fact, the more grob one can become and the more dangerous one can become, unless one is consciously working on maintaining one's refinement and on developing one's spirituality at the same time. Now we're getting even further. And we're saying not only does Torah not automatically bring to Menschlichkeit, we are saying Menschlichkeit brings to Torah. That you need to get to the Ahavta l'reicha kamoicha first. Then you can start understanding what Torah is all about. When you've broken those barriers between people, when you no longer see other people as physical opponents to yourself, but rather as spiritual partners to yourself, then you can start thinking about understanding the breaking of barriers between oneself and the Ribbono Shel Olam, between oneself and God. It's the Menschlichkeit that brings to the Frumkeit, not the Frumkeit that brings to the Menschlichkeit. Everybody is amazed, both in this country and overseas, particularly in Israel, at the tremendous rate of progress that South African young people make in yeshivas overseas. So it's abnormal. More so than the young people from any other country. This is already accepted and recognized that the best caliber of student is South African. If any South African wants to get into a yeshiva, they can get into just about any yeshiva they want. All they have to say is, I'm from South Africa. And already the Rosh Yeshiva is smiling, and he might want to stand it a little bit higher first. He might send you somewhere else first for a couple of years, but no door will be closed to any South African anywhere. Why? People always ask why. This might have something to do with it. Why it is that there's a certain Menschlichkeit to South African upbringing, that I don't know. Well, certainly there has been up till this point. I don't know why that is. Is it the Litvish background? Is it the Torah background that our parents or grandparents or at most great-grandparents came from. One doesn't know exactly what it is. But there's always been a certain menschlichkeit to South African upbringing. Always, for years and years, that's been remarked about. Not just Jews, Gentiles as well. And the discipline that there's been in schools as opposed to schools overseas, the way people treat their elders, the way people treat one another. There's a certain politeness, a certain refinement. Quite nothing to do with Torah. If that's the case, then it's possible to make great progress in Torah. If there is that menschlichkeit, if there's a bit of the ahavta l'reicha kamoicha that can be developed and that can be expanded and that can be built upon, from there can be great progress in Torah. But it is not possible to make progress in Torah when one is unable to extinguish the barriers between one another. The concept exists now of loving another human being as oneself, and understanding the closeness and feeling the closeness between people as a precondition not only for interpersonal relationships and for love, but also for the relationship between a human being and the Torah, between a human being and the Ribbono Shel Olam. And it now becomes very important to understand how to do it. How does one break those barriers? How does one start feeling that he and I are the same? How do we start feeling that you are just another part of my body and I'm another part of your body? We're all part of the same neshama. It's all very nice speaking about these highly flighty little things and neshamas and sparks of the Ribbono Shel Olam and love and all. It's all very nice. But practically, how does one do it? What does one do to develop the experience and the feeling that two people are in fact one, so that there can be that ahava, so that there can be that love? There is a concept, and this is the concept that I don't know if we're going to finish this evening. Probably we won't. The Mishnah in Pirkei Avos lists 48 kinyonim of Torah. 48 changes that a person has to undergo before he can acquire Torah. 48 things that a person has. You can't just walk off the street and start learning Torah and think one knows what's going on. 48 changes that need to take place. One of those changes is called Nosei Be'oil Im Chaveira, to share the burden with a friend. That's one of the things one needs to do. Again, we see the same principle, that there has to be a certain caliber of interpersonal relationships before there can be progress in religion, before there can be progress in Torah. There has to be, among many others, a lot of them are Bein Odom L'Chaveira. Most of them are in fact interpersonal. But this particular one that we're dealing with, Nosei Be'oil Im Chaveira, that you have to develop the ability to share the burden with your friend. And you need to do that in order to understand Torah. If you don't have the ability of Nosei Be'oil, if you don't have the ability of being able to share somebody else's burden, it's not possible that one can make progress in Torah. This Nosei Be'oil Im Chaveira, I think, is the key to starting off this giving expression to this concept of breaking down the barriers between people. But one needs to understand what the concept is. Chumash says a very strange thing in Shemos, and Rashi is even stranger. Says that Paro died, and we quote it in the Haggadah every year. Vayeonchu b'nei Yisrael min ha'avoda vayizaku, and b'nei Yisrael sighed from the hard work, and they shouted out to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Vatal shav osom el ha'elokim min ha'avoda, and their cry from their work went up to God. Vayishma elokim es na'akosom, and the Ribbono Shel Olam heard their cries. Vayizkor Elokim es briso, and Hashem remembered His covenant, es Avraham, es Yitzchok, es Yaakov, which He had made with Avraham, Yitzchok, and Yaakov. Vayar Elokim es bnei Yisrael, and Hashem saw bnei Yisrael. Vayeda Elokim, and Hashem knew. What does that mean? He saw them and He knew. Says Rashi, Nosan aleihem leiv veloi heilim einov. He applied his heart to them, course, these are words used to describe the Ribbono Shel Olam. It doesn't have a heart, and it doesn't. But just to try and understand what the words mean, says Rashi, Nosan Aleihem Leiv. He applied his heart to Bnei Yisrael, V'loy He'elim Einov, and he didn't turn his eyes aside. So people ask, what does it mean? And up till now, did he not see? Up till now, did he not notice that they were suffering? Up till now, were his eyes turned aside? They were busy there shouting and crying and suffering, and he didn't see. All of a sudden now, the Pharaoh dies and they give a shout. Oy, gewalt, they shout. And the Ribbono Shel Olam says, oh, Tati, yeah, you're suffering. Didn't notice. Sorry, I didn't see. It doesn't make any sense. But we see here that there are two stages to noticing somebody else's suffering. The one is noticing, and that everybody should be able to do all of the time. To notice that somebody else is suffering, that should not be a difficult thing. But there's another aspect, and that is to notice, to be noseibol im chaver, to share the suffering with somebody else, to feel their suffering. We think it's exactly the same as we talked about earlier, understanding Maharal and understanding Gemara. We read over it, and if we really feel very dedicated, we read over it two or three times. And if we really consider ourselves specialists on the Maharal already, we think about it for half an hour after we've read it three times, and then we really start telling people what the Maharal says. Maharal says this, Maharal says that, as if we understand what he's talking about. We tend to think we understand things a lot quicker than we do. And we tend to think that when we've seen somebody else suffering, that we're already mevinim, we already understand all about it. Now we talk about their suffering, and we give lectures about their suffering, and all sorts of parts, opinions about their suffering, we know about it all. How do you know? Suffering is not something, unfortunately, that one can understand unless one's gone through it. Nor can one understand one kind of suffering if one has only gone through another kind of suffering. Every suffering is unique. And it isn't possible. And it isn't possible to understand the suffering of another person unless one has experienced it. One lady once said to a gynecologist that she doesn't understand how he has the chutzpah to be a gynecologist. Why? He said, and she said this while he was busy delivering her baby. And he said, why? What's the problem? He said, have you ever had a baby? Do you know what it's like? It would be good advice telling everybody what to do. Have you any idea what it's like? He said, every gynecologist should at least have a baby once to know what it's like. And it is like that. It's not possible for a man to understand what childbirth is. It's not possible for a healthy person to understand what sickness is, what illness is. It's not possible for a wealthy person to understand what poverty is unless he went through it. It's also not possible for a poor person to understand what wealth is. That's also got its own tsar and its own sorrows and its own problems. Not possible to understand. And each person thinks that he's a big maven on everybody else's tsaros. Yeah, I understand his difficulties. We don't understand other people's difficulties. Rabbi Yerucham tells the story that somebody once came up to him and said, how many times do you turn over in bed before you fall asleep? Rabbi Yerucham was rather taken aback with the question. It's not the normal kind of question that a Talmud asks a Rebbe. So he said, what are you trying to say? He said, I've just gone to visit a sick person who can't turn over. He can't turn in bed himself. And I stopped to try and think what he must suffer. And I suddenly realized that I don't even know how many times I turn over in bed at night. So how is it possible for me to know how he suffers? So for granted do we take these things when we've got them. And we think we suffer Nebuchadnezzar. You know, so-and-so, he can't even turn over in bed. Ah. And then we carry on drinking our whiskey and smoking our cigarettes. And we think we understand what it's all about. It's not possible. We don't understand. The second stage of Noseh Ba'ol, after one's got to the stage where you just notice that somebody else is suffering. And I said earlier, that's something that everybody should have. Perhaps the word to stress is should. One doesn't. It's amazing how you can walk past a person who's suffering too terribly and just not notice. Not notice the loneliness. Not notice the desperation sometimes in an individual. Just walk past, speak to him even. Hello, how are you? Everything alright? Fine, good, see you sometime, bye. And didn't even notice that the man is in the depths of despair. One needs to be able to do it. It's hard. But the next step is to actually become physically involved in his suffering. And that's much harder. Actually decide, I'm going to apply myself to his suffering. I'm going to learn it up like I learned the Sugya of Gemara. I want to understand it. Not just I've seen it. That's when I've seen it, I've noticed, and I feel sorry. And that alone can bring one to tears. But we're going much further than that. I really want to get to the depths of it. I want to be mimic in it. I want to get deep. I want to understand. I want to feel what that man is feeling. That's the second step of Noseh Be'olim Chaveiro. And in fact, it's really the first step. That's what Noseh Be'olim Chaveiro means. To share his burden. What does share his burden mean? That you suffer like him. Doesn't mean that you stand in your comfort and say, ah, Nebuch, I understand you're having a rough time. That's not Noseh Be'olim. That's maybe a bit of chesed, a bit of kindness, but it's not Noseh Be'olim. Noseh Be'olim means I bear the burden of another human being. I share the burden of another human being, which means that I suffer with him. I feel what he is feeling. And if one doesn't get to that, one isn't at Noseh Be'olim. And if one isn't at Noseh Be'olim, one of the 48 kinyonim are missing, and it's not possible to make great progress in learning. It's not possible to make great progress in Torah. One needs to be able to be a Noseh Be'olim. When the Ribbono Shel Olam says, Nosan Aleihem Lev, he's teaching us this second stage. At this point, God became involved in their suffering. He didn't just see them suffering. Of course, he saw them suffering all the time. It disturbed him. It made him sad. It concerned him. It worried him. And he was waiting every day for it to be over. But he didn't get involved in their suffering. He didn't really go into it the way he did at this point. When Nosan Aleihem Lev, he applied his heart to their suffering. There's a beautiful medrash which Rashi brings much further on in Mishpotim, in Kaf Dalet, verse Yud, where it says, Vayiru is Elokei Yisrael, and they saw Hashem, v'sachas raglov, and under his feet, kemaasei livnas ha-sapir. There was a brick made of sapphire, sapir, some kind of precious stone. Says Rashi, what was that brick doing there? Hi hoysa lefonov b'shas ha-shibud. Hashem used to keep that brick during the enslavement in Egypt. Liz kod tzoroson shel Yisrael, to remember the tzorah of Yisrael, shehoyu meshubodim b'maisel levenim, who were involved working with bricks. What does that mean? The Ribbono Shel Olam needs a brick to remind him? Without that he wouldn't know? So again, that we're making no attempt at trying to understand the deeper Kabbalah involved, and clearly this can't be taken on any kind of literal sense. But the Medrash is there to teach us something. The Medrash is there to teach us that Kibiyachal, so to say, the Ribbono Shel Olam had his own little brick. What did he do with the brick? Just look at it. He didn't need a brick up there to look at. He could have looked at the bricks in Mitzrayim. He can see. So what did he have his brick there for? He had his brick there for because he used to put it on his shoulder and he used to walk up and down with it, so to say. Just to feel what it's like to carry bricks. Because even a god, so to say, can't understand. At least that's what we're being taught, that no matter how high you are, and how clever you are, and how perceptive you are, and how sensitive you are, if you don't have a brick on your back, don't think that you understand the first thing about the tsar, the humiliation, the back-breaking effort, the soul-breaking work involved in carrying bricks. If you want to feel it, there's only one way to do it. You've got to have your little brick. And put it on your shoulder and start walking and feel what it's like. Then you'll know. That's the only way. You want to know what it's like to lie in bed and be unable to turn over? Get somebody to tie you in bed that you can't turn and feel what it's like. Then you begin to understand how that other person is suffering. See if you can fall asleep like that. And if you can fall asleep, see how long it takes you before you wake up again. See how you operate the next day. See how you function the next day. And do it a second night and a third night and a fourth night. And then you can say, maybe I'm beginning to understand what that other person is suffering. You lie in your silly posturpedic, turning from one side to the other side, backwards and forwards, and Nebuch, you think you understand how this person is suffering. We understand. What understand? You don't even notice when you turn over. You don't even know what effort is involved in turning over. You don't understand what a person is suffering who's having difficulty breathing? A person who's got lung problems? Close your nose. Stop breathing. See what it's like. Allow yourself to breathe every 3/4 of a minute and see how you can function. And then begin to say, oh, now I begin to understand what that other person is suffering. Better still, don't hold your own nose. Get somebody else to hold your nose. Then one will begin to understand what it is to be so restricted. That there's nothing you can do. There's no way out. You're trapped. You've just got to wait until you can draw this next breath. because you can't do anything in between. And then it's shaykh to begin to understand. Even the Ribbono Shel Olam had his own little brick, perhaps not such a little brick, that he used to keep, and he used to use it to feel, to be able to feel. When it says here that Nosan Aleihem Lev, he started paying attention to really become involved in their tzoras. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam used to do. He didn't used to sit back and look down and say, Nebuch, my poor children, look how hard they're working. And this is something which Moshe Rabbeinu himself did. Moshe Rabbeinu was raised in the Paris palace. He didn't have to work. It wasn't those days when Moshe became great and he went out to his brothers. What was his greatness? And he saw their suffering. What does it mean, and he saw their suffering? Up till now he didn't see their suffering. Says Rashi, exactly the same concept. He applied his eyes and his heart to experience the tzar that the other people were feeling. He became involved, he became deeply involved in their tzoras. Says the Medrash, he used to cry, it used to bring him to tears. The Omer used to say, it hurts me about you. If my life could save you, I would rather die than see you suffering. That's what suffering is. That's what Moshe Boim is. When you feel already that you want to die, because you can't tolerate the suffering anymore. Again, that's something that people tend to regard as a selfish feeling. You can't tolerate the suffering, so you want it to stop. Doesn't matter if it's a selfish feeling. We're all one being in any case. And all that's happening is I'm feeling your suffering. That's exactly what it's meant to be. She'ein lecho melocho koshe mimleches hatit. There is no work more difficult than dealing with cement and with mortar. And he used to take his shoulder and he used to help each one of them. He used to go out, the Prince Moshe, and he used to go out and he used to watch them. He used to carry the bricks with them. And the Medrash says not just that he used to do to them, but every single one. Why? If he just wanted to experience what it was like carrying bricks, why didn't he just carry a few bricks every day? Why did he actually go to each Jew and help that Jew carry that brick? Because every person suffers differently. He didn't want to feel what it's like to be Moshe supporting bricks. He wanted to feel what it's like to be Yankel and to be Chaimke and to be Yitzchok and these people. He wants to feel what it's like to be them carrying bricks. And not carrying this brick, carrying that brick that he's carrying. That's Moshe Boelim Chaveirov. To be able to experience his suffering, not my suffering. So Moshe went and had an opportunity with every Jew to carry their bricks with them on their shoulder, so that he could share that load and feel what it felt like to be him, not what it felt like to be me. That's Moshe Ba'olim Chavera. I was looking just as we were coming, getting the shiur ready, and I saw Mr. Cohen. I don't think that you're the oldest person in the shiur. Are you the oldest person in the shiur? Exactly. All right. I saw the oldest gentleman. I say so with your permission, right? Okay. Sorry. I saw the oldest man in the shiur, who is also a Cohen, carrying a shtender from the shul past all the young men right through here. Having to wait for people to move out of his way, and then people saw him and moved out of his way and let him carry on carrying it. Until finally Russell took it from him over here. I counted 15 people that actually had to move out of his way to let him carry the shtender. I'm not counting the people who saw him carrying the shtender. I'm counting how many people actually had to move out of his way. Noisei ba'olim chaveira. We understand what it is for other people to feel something. Young people standing and watching. What is it in us? What has happened? And we're frum. Yeah. We've been a Torah, you see. We're frum. Our parents, no, they're not religious. We are chazrim b'tshuva. We're balei tshuva, you see. Our parents know nothing about all this. We're the new generation. Now, we've learnt. We know it all. What do we know? Absolutely nothing. We don't even know the alephbeis that our parents know. Well, so we put on tefillin now, we keep Shabbos now, we keep Kav. What's it all worth? If we don't know how to, the very basics of it all. Don't know what it is to help another person to support another person, to take a load off another person, to share something with another person. That we've lost, but we've gained all the other little things. What is it? What has happened to us? And the way we look down on all the other people. What happens if somebody who doesn't keep Shabbos touches my wine? Am I allowed to make Kiddush with it? Big Shaila. What a chutzpah. Shaila is whether you're allowed to make wine if you touch the wine. Not the keeping Shabbos. Keeping Shabbos is important if you're a mensch. But if an ape starts keeping Shabbos, is he allowed to touch the wine? What is it? This is not humanity. This is not what it is to be a mensch. This is not what it is to be a yid, to be a ben Torah. We've just forgotten Torah. We don't know what it's all about. Absolutely not the first clue about what the Ribbono Shel'olam expects of us, what the Ribbono Shel'olam wants from us. We sit here, Motzei Shabbos after Motzei Shabbos, morning after morning, evening after evening, getting more pompous and more self-righteous by the day, and less religious by the day. The toes we stand on, the people we hurt and humiliate, the loyalties we neglect, the responsibilities we don't accept, the suffering we cause and the suffering that we don't notice, and we're busy becoming religious. How crooked is the world? How sick is the world? And that the outside world is sick, so we won't be able to change the outside world. But our own little world, how difficult is it to change that? Surely that's what learning means is all about. Surely that's it. And how often are these things even talked about? One doesn't find it. One goes into yeshivas and one hears shiurim. One goes into Bas Medrash, one hears shiurim. On what are the shiurim? How often are the shiurim on this? Probably people take for granted that this is understood. Once upon a time maybe this was understood. But that's been lost. It was lost together with the Shabbos that was lost. It was lost together with the Kashrus that was lost. It was lost together with everything else that was lost. How to relate to people? How to relate to people our own age? How to relate to people younger than us? Never mind how to relate to people older than us, wiser than us. How to relate to Talmidei Chachomim? How to relate to people who are ill? How to relate to people who are suffering? And everybody's suffering. I'll never forget when I had been a rabbi in Stellenbosch for about a year, I got married. And my wife came down and I introduced her to all the community, which didn't take very long. And she said, you know, it's a lovely place and I'd love to spend a couple of years here, but I think we're wasting our time here. They don't need us here. I said, why not? She said, everybody's so happy. Everybody's so nice. By that stage already 80% of the community was keeping kashrus. A few people were really beginning to keep Shabbos. It was nice, and everybody was menschlich and nice and happy. And she said, don't you think we should rather go to a place that has problems? We don't have to come to a place like this. So I didn't say anything, I just smiled. It wasn't 3 months later that she said, remember, I talked about how happy everybody is. Do you realize that in the last 3 months, the tremendous problems that every single family has had here, and we went through the list. Nebuch, every single family. And then I said to her, you should know that's not unique to Stellenbosch. Any community we will ever go to, we should know that at any given time of a short period, every family will have its problems. Different problems, different pressures, different things. Sometimes one knows about it, sometimes one doesn't know about it. A problem with children, a problem with parents, a problem with a husband, a problem with a wife, a financial problem, a health problem. Something all the time with somebody. Families are big and they're complex. And is it easy for a family to sail through months after months without problems? And some of the problems are heartbreaking. Some of the problems are severe. And we don't notice it. And let me tell you, us sitting over here, those of you that I know, and I'm sure it applies to those of you that I don't know so well as well, sorrows and problems, each one of us. Some of us feel more confident of being able to handle it the moment we're up. Sometimes we're down. We go through our ups and our downs. Sometimes our problems get on top of us. And sometimes we're on top of our problems. But they're there all the time with every single individual. We smile and we say hello and we're happy. Just scratch beneath the surface. And their broken hearts and their sleepless nights and their worries and their concerns. And we sit next to each other and we get up and we go and we sit next to each other again next week without a clue of what's going on at all. It doesn't interest us. We don't notice. We don't care. What is it that's happening? Is that Yiddishkeit? And we're not even talking about the moral side of Yiddishkeit and the interpersonal side of Yiddishkeit. V'yavtu l'recha kamoicha ze klal gadol b'toira. Without that there is no Torah. The Shabbos is no Shabbos. The Kashrus is no Kashrus. The learning is no learning. The davening is no davening. The tefillin is no tefillin. It's nothing. It's not worth anything. Ze klal gadol b'toira. V'yavtu l'recha kamoicha. Until we can start feeling that we're all part of the same Ribbono Shel Olam, that we're all part of the same greater Meshoma, that we all affect each other, that we feel each other's suffering, and not just from a distance, but that I've carried the same brick that you've carried, because you carrying it is me carrying it. And the same as when my hand is in pain, I feel the pain. If I cut off my hand, the pain will go. That's not how it is. The problem is here, but the pain is here. So the problem might be there, but the pain has to be here. Only there can there begin to be and eventually a basis on which a Torah community can be founded, a basis on which a Torah community can be structured. Somebody was telling me last night of a community in Eretz Yisrael, one of many, one of hundreds of worldwide, where a group of women got together and they've arranged, you know how difficult things are in Israel, living conditions and so on, that when a woman goes into hospital to have a baby, they deliver meals to the home and they deliver meals to the woman, and when she comes home they arrange for her to have an ozeret, they arrange domestic help for her and nappy services and all sorts of things, and it all costs a few pennies if anything at all. Oh, voluntary work within the community. What is it? Doesn't every woman suffer when she has a baby? What has to be done? Every family, the reorganization, the problems, the sometimes just financial problems. Nothing. And when one thinks about it, and I was saying when this discussion was going on, you know, never mind having babies, but altogether, there are so many things that a family use for a few months of its life. That's it. All in all, a few months or maybe a couple of years of its life. And sometimes some of these items are very expensive. Why is it that people don't get together and pool resources a little bit? How many prams does a community need? How many various different things? If there's wheelchairs, let's say. It happens sometimes one family needs, another family needs, but there's no need to buy one every time one needs, and then you go and lock it up somewhere. How difficult would it be for communities to organize among themselves to pool resources in those areas where families need particular items and particular help at particular times, and not again? But we don't do it. Why don't we do it? You know, the story they tell of what is Gehenna and what is hell. And I tell the story of this man that comes up, he'll be shown Gehenna, and what is it? Take him up, and there's this table laid with the most beautiful food. It's just unbelievable what it is. He never saw such food in living memory. And there in Gehenna, this terrible place, this table behind every chair, there's a waiter with a white uniform and a red sash. Each man has his own waiter, and there's the best wine. Everything's beautiful and wonderful. Comfortable chairs. And there, all these members of the Society of Gehenna are gathered around the table. He looks and he says, "My goodness, is this Gehenna?" And his guide says, "Yes." He says, "Look at them. Look at them. Look at the food. Look at them." He looks, "Wee, they're so thin. What happened? Have you just put the food here in honor of me?" No, they say, "The food is laid out every day here. The food is laid out just the same." "So why are they so thin?" So he says, "Well, watch them eating." He looks, "Nobody's eating." "Ah," he says, "I see why nobody's eating, because you've given them very long knives and forks. They can't fit the knives and forks into their mouths." So he says, "You stupid people. You're going to die of starvation this way. Chaimke, you take the spoon on your end of the table and feed Yankel opposite you. Yankel, you feed Chaimke." And they start, "Me feed him? I would rather die than see him eating." Oh, then he understood what Gehenna is. And that's where we live. That's where we live. That's not life after death. That's life before death. Each one doing their own thing. And one looks and says, "But it would be so easy. If you would do this for you and you would do this for you, you would both have such an easy time." No, that we wouldn't. I must have my own. They must have their own. It's these barriers that we're talking about that get put up. And we will not take them down. We will not do things which will make our own lives easier. Never mind somebody else's life easier. We're all one. Make him more comfortable, it's making me more comfortable. We will not do it. Why not? There's no after l'recha kamoicha. There's no noisa ba'olim chaveira. We just don't understand. occasionally when a big Maaseh Chesed is done, we hear about it. Whew, wonderful thing, so-and-so, without being asked, quietly went and he helped so-and-so out. It happens, Baruch Hashem, in our community too, that unbeknown to anybody, such acts of Chesed are committed. But they're not the norm. It's not the normal thing. A few individuals, it's always the same individuals over and over again who do it, the same individuals who notice the need, the same individuals who act on it, and when it's done, it's always a pill, it's always unusual. That should be normal Jewish life. Every day that's the way it should be done. This month I've got a bit more money than I need, I know you've got a little bit less than you need, you take my extra this month. Next month I'll need a bit, you'll give it back to me. That's the way it should be going all the time in a community. But it isn't like that. That's what's mine is mine, and what's yours is yours, and the barriers between us. We're operating as bodies, not as souls. There is no feeling that we're all part of the same. We talked about understanding what is it that brings one to the level. If we've tied everything down in Ava, we've accepted that both according to the Maharal and according to the Hakedo, the bottom line is that there should be closeness. The bottom line is that we love ourselves, and what we're trying is we're trying to learn to love other people like ourselves. Unfortunately, the easiest emotion to feel is pain. That's the easiest, and we understand it quickest. To feel joy also, we must learn how to share in other people's simchas as well. It's also quite amazing. People will have simchas, and first they'll be invited to go and join in the simcha, and then they're busy that night. They've got other things on. Always something else on, always busy. So simcha, share somebody else's simcha. We're too busy. Everybody's too busy with their own things to really bother about what other people are experiencing. But leaving aside simcha even, on the level of tzar, just of understanding other people's suffering, that's the easiest area in which we can start feeling that we're all part of the same body. If a human being doesn't understand that his hand is part of him, the easiest way to teach him is to prick his finger with a pin. And when he says, ouch, say, why did you say ouch? I pricked your finger, not you. Oh, then you'd understand my finger is me. Oh, you shukarach, now you know. It's the same in interpersonal relationships. Unfortunately, the easiest way to understand these things is to be able to experience the pain and the suffering of other people. And who knows, although one believes that anybody who suffers there's a reason for it, but who knows whether part of the reason sometimes isn't, so that other people should notice also. But the Ribbono Shel Olam wants a community to begin to understand that they belong to one another, and that they are related to one another, and that they are responsible for one another. And who knows whether sometimes suffering isn't thrown into a community, irrespective of who it happens to land on, just to elicit the right response from other people. Who knows whether that doesn't sometimes happen too. Be that as it may, the need to notice, which is step number one, but more than that, the need to become involved, latet level his bone, to apply one's mind and one's intellect and one's thought and one's feeling, to keep one's little brick that one can carry, to go and carry the bricks together with them, to feel what it's like, to really understand other people's suffering. One needs to start doing that in order to become alert to the fact that there are other people, that they do feel, and that they feel the same way as we do, and that they have tzoras at all times just as we do, and that we need to be able to be noseh be'olim chaveiro before we can take any meaningful steps in Yiddishkeit, before there can be any substantial progress in religiousness. And in learning, there has to be some very basic progress in sensitivity, in understanding of one another, and in taking the effort to get to grips with helping one another and sharing in one another's problems and in one another's difficulties. And with that, hopefully comes not only a noseh be'olim chaveiro, but the ahavta l'reicha kamoicha, a love of a neighbor as oneself. And with that, is a klal gadol b'Torah. Then one's learning improves, and one's mitzvahs improve. One's Ahavas Hashem improves, one starts knowing and understanding what it is to love the Ribbono Shel Olam, and a whole new relationship between God and ourselves and between ourselves and ourselves is established, which can lead to heights and to experiences which perhaps at this stage are beyond our wildest expectations.